from St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Missourians will make a profoundly consequential decision later this year. With Governor Mike Parson unable to run again due to term limits, three major GOP contenders are now running hard to take his place. That includes State Senator Bill Eigel, a Weldon Spring lawmaker who has gained a reputation in Jefferson City for sparring with Republican leaders over a host of issues, including congressional redistricting, economic development programs, and efforts to make the Missouri Constitution harder to amend. And in the run-up to the August 6th primary, Eigel is hoping Missouri Republicans will flock to his campaign instead of Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe or Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft. Joining us now is State Senator Bill Eigel, who has served almost two full terms in the Missouri Senate representing parts of St. Charles County. Senator, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Jason, thanks for having me.
So this was a tumultuous legislative session, to put it mildly, especially with the inability of lawmakers to place something on the ballot that would make the Missouri Constitution harder to amend. If you were governor right now, how would you have navigated that ballot item to voters and convinced Missourians that they should give up some of their power to alter the state constitution?
Well, so two answers to that question. First, if I were the governor, I would have called a special session a year ago and had legislators in Jefferson City long before we got to the regular session. In the context of a special session, I think that we could have gotten a product through and sent to the voters long, well in advance of any of the pro-abortion measures that are probably going to end up on the November ballot at this point. How would I have navigated discussing this and articulating this to the people of the state? Well, right now we have relative to the changing of a lot of constitutions across the country, state constitutions, it's relatively easy to change the Missouri Constitution. You need a certain number of signatures in six of the eight congressional districts, and you need just a simple majority vote in the next election that it's brought up, which means that you can actually run up big majorities in either the rural areas or the urban areas and get changes to the founding document of the state. If you compare that to, say, the federal constitution, the standard of changing the federal constitution, of course, is much greater. Not only do you have to pass something through both chambers of Congress, you have to get a supermajority of states to ratify that as well. So from my perspective, requiring a broader consensus of what is probably Missouri's biggest demographic divide between urban and rural interests, requiring a consensus between those two groups, if we're going to change the founding document of the state, makes a whole lot of sense to me. And it makes a whole lot of sense to a lot of Missourians who have seen some pretty powerful, well-funded, out-of-state special interests get questions to the item and eventually into the Constitution.
We'll get to some of those ballot items later in this conversation, but this entire discussion about leadership and gubernatorial effectiveness gets to a question from Nick on Twitter. Just based on this legislative session, how does Eigel expect to get anything done, especially if Democrats can find a way to break or at least narrow the legislative supermajority? I think this is a question you get every time you do an interview. Like, how are you actually going to accomplish things when a lot of your senators didn't support your ideas in the last 7 or 8 years? So fire away.
Well, the first thing I would say is the only reason that the Democratic superminorities were able to do what they did is because they had so much cooperation from so many Republicans that went along with their ideas about derailing the initiative petition reform bill. And that's just one example. But to the broader point in the question, how does a guy like Bill Eigel, who has been relatively controversial, who has been very aggressive about being confrontational when it's required in Jefferson City, bring together a very fractured Republican Party? And I think every Republican I've talked to has acknowledged that the Republican Party is fractured. Well, the answer to that question is actually pretty simple, because unlike Mike Parson, unlike Mike Kehoe, unlike Jay Ashcroft, I'm going to call on Republicans to do Republican things. I mean, look at other states right now that I think are doing much better than the state of Missouri. You have state, big red states, Tennessee, Florida, Texas. You know, it's not that those states don't have moderate Republicans in their legislature. It's not that they don't have so-called rhinos that, if given the opportunity, would betray the GOP platform and work with the Democrats. The difference between those states and our state is that unlike those states, we have a huge absence of vacuum of leadership in the number one spot, and that's Governor Parson. Look at his last State of the State address. He's talking about all these new government programs that he wants to spend taxpayer money on. This is the governor that wanted to raise the gas tax. This is the governor that I don't think stood nearly enough in the gap to stop the expansion of Medicaid in this state. And when we've needed him the most on these big, generationally defining issues like protecting our Constitution from the pro-abortionists who want in one stroke to roll back 20 years of pro-life progress, he was absent. He didn't say anything. So there's an old saying that the only thing for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Well, we have too many folks in statewide office right now that did nothing.
But who are you to say that your Republican colleagues don't want Republican things? Isn't it possible that they don't want to do your things that you define as Republican things?
Well, I mean, look at their voting records. I mean, look at the things that many of my biggest critics in the Missouri Senate have been voting for. They've been voting for dramatic increases in wasteful spending. They have voted directly against the tax cuts that I've wanted to bring forward that would actually lessen that burden. We've had Republicans vote against the prohibition on red flag gun laws that would help strengthen our Second Amendment protections that we have. These are all things, and I don't know if there is a single Republican in existence that didn't campaign and talk about resisting Medicaid expansion under Obamacare at every turn, and yet every one of them, not every one of them, but so many of them are now voting to fully fund Medicaid expansion
because
under Obamacare.
Because the court says you have to.
Well, the courts say a lot of things that independent branches of other government, whether it's the legislature or the executive branch, don't necessarily have to agree with. And don't get me wrong. I respect the court's opinions. I'm happy to take their advice. But if they do something
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's not really advice. The court opinion that you're talking about said if you don't fund Medicaid expansion, then Medicaid would effectively run out of money really quickly because
Wait a minute. Medicaid's going to run out of money really quickly here in the next few years. I mean, if that's what we're talking about, the reality is I don't think that we have a sustainable Medicaid program anyway. I have no rational theory as to why we think we can continue funding the kind of dramatic increase in costs in our Medicaid program, which, as you know, Jason, are north of $300 million every single year. That's not sustainable. And by the way, half of the dollars we're getting from Washington, D.C. are printed and borrowed. And when we lose that ability, the Medicaid program is in grave danger of going away. So I don't necessarily see that that's the reason that we had to listen to the courts. I actually have seen the courts, the judicial branch in the state of Missouri, diverge relatively significantly from the GOP platform and what the legislative and executive branches have wanted to do.
We also got several questions like this one from Angie Marie on Threads. Will he represent all Missourians or just his extreme right-wing supporters? I live in St. Charles County, and he's never been empathetic to anyone with a different view than him. So, in addition to responding to Anne Marie on Threads' question, what are some issues you think you could find common ground with Democrats on? Because I just mentioned it's possible that they may have more tangible legislative power after 2025. If you're governor, you can try to bulldoze over them as much as you want. But are there any issues that you think you could agree with Democrats on?
Well, I'm always surprised when the Democratic super minority disagrees with my position on personal property tax. I mean, personal property tax, and I know we're going to talk about this more, but personal property tax is a regressive tax. As a percentage of income, it hammers our working and middle income class households that are struggling to just stay in their homes, not to mention their cars, that every December 1st, they've got to pay $400 or $500 for a car that may be 8 to 10 years old. I mean, that's crazy. Most states have actually gotten away from personal property tax on vehicles in particular. And I suspect you have more questions about this.
Oh, I do.
Keep in mind that the discussion about personal property tax is not a discussion about whether or not most rational human beings in this state want to continue to fund the local services like police, fire, and schools that we see in every state, including the ones that don't have personal property tax. It is a conversation about whether or not we should think that charging somebody rent on their cars every December 1st is the right way to do it. 29 other states have already figured out the answer to that question is no. That's why I've made it a major plank in my platform that we're going to be the 30th.
So let's be specific. If you got your way and were able to eliminate the personal property tax, would it just be the state portion of the personal property tax or also the local and school district part? Yes. Basically.
Yes.
So everything. Everything would go away.
In fact, the state portion is
pretty small, actually.
Yeah, very minuscule. I think there's just a couple million dollars. And actually, if we talk about the overall impact of that, you know, the value of every personal property tax bill in the state for every citizen, every county, every business that they take in collectively at the local level is about $1.7 billion. Over the past 5 years, we've increased state spending overall by $25 billion. In fact, if you take out the federal dollars that have come down as a result of the COVID environment, we've still increased general revenue spending by billions and billions of dollars. So my plan, the question of how are we going to do it, we're going to get rid of personal property tax because the state actually gets to set the assessment rate, which is at 33.3% right now. We can ratchet that down to zero. And then by getting rid of just a little bit of the waste in that budget, even the general revenue portions of that budget, we'll have more than enough money to keep the local areas whole.
So Rick Van Deven on Threads asked, and you were definitely expecting this question, how will local communities fund schools, roads, and emergency services without personal property taxes? Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned in the past, mm-hmm. you don't want to replace this tax with another tax.
A new tax.
So Special School District of St. Louis County gets all of its money from property taxes, including personal property taxes. If personal property tax goes away and there's nothing to replace it, they could lose tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that specifically goes to educate disabled kids. Mm-hmm. So how would that entity be made whole under your plan?
Under my plan, we're going to use the surpluses of general revenue in Jefferson City that we are going to achieve with just a little bit of fiscal conservatism that you know Republicans always talk about in campaign season, right? But we haven't seen delivered by the current leadership in Jefferson City. And we're going to make whatever local areas are getting in personal property tax revenues now, we'll keep them whole for that amount with basically general revenue surpluses from the state. In a broader sense, though—
Is that sustainable, though?
It's sustainable. Absolutely.
Won't you run out of general revenue eventually from the surplus?
I feel very confident. In fact, every single year I've been in the Senate, we've seen general revenue surpluses increase. In fact, just last year, the increases in general revenue, just the increased general revenue amount over the prior year was $2 billion. It was actually more than the total amount for personal property tax revenues. So we could have, just last year alone, we could have gotten rid of every personal property tax bill just using the natural increases in general revenue we got at the state and still had $300 million left over. But we didn't do that. Instead, last year's budget included more than $10 billion in new decision items, most of which were incredibly wasteful items that if a vast majority of the population of Missouri understood what that money was being wasted on, I think they'd be pretty upset.
We're talking with State Senator Bill Eichel. He's one of three major Republican candidates to be the state's next governor. So I want to talk about an issue that I've been focusing on a lot, and that's child abuse investigators. I've asked you about this a couple times, but I understand what you're saying about the budget and how we're spending a lot of money, but it's hard for me to hear something like that and also know that we're paying people that go to houses of potentially abused children $43,000 a year, mm-hmm. which is like $30,000 less than Illinois and far less than the private sector. Like, would you commit to working with the legislature to making sure the salaries of Children's Division investigators are competitive with other states in the private sector?
Yes. In fact, in addition to that, you know, Jason, you know this year that one of the items that was in the budget was a pay raise for teachers, bringing up the starting salary of our teachers. The cost of that line item just to give a raise, a pretty sizable raise to our teacher, was only about $14 million. It was a relatively, in the context of a $53 billion budget, in that broad context, was a drop in the bucket. And actually, here's when we talk about our state workforce. You know, our state workforce has about 55,000 positions. 55,000 positions, twice that of other states with a similar population size like Indiana that has half the number of positions. So I think we can find dramatic reductions in our state workforce. In fact, of those 55,000 positions, at any given time, 5,000 to 7,000 of those positions are empty, have been empty, maybe for years in certain instances.
Are they empty because the salaries are too low?
Perhaps. Or maybe we just don't need them. So I think that
I wouldn't. Would you work as a child abuse investigator for $43,000 a year?
Well,
I know you agreed with me, but I just want you to answer that question.
That's a great question. I don't think that there's any doubt that whether it's our teachers, whether it's our highway patrolmen, whether it's the child abuse investigators, we can and should be able to pay these folks more to reward them, to encourage them not only to be recruited by the state, but to be retained by the state. But even beyond that, each of those individual line items are a fraction of the overall budget. We have so much ability to not only make savings in that budget, but to pay for the services. I don't know that there's a person, there's not a politician in this state that you could bring onto this show and ask them if they wouldn't be willing to support the investigators for child abuse. Every single politician would say yes to that question.
But they haven't done it. They didn't do it this cycle. They didn't do it the last year.
I don't know.
I mean, you're part of the Senate.
I've been voting against these budgets. Absolutely.
Yeah, understood.
And I think that it's very important that while they weren't taking care of the child abuse investigators, Jason, we spent tens of millions of dollars for private stadium upgrades. We spent tens of millions of dollars for a synthetic meat laboratory. We spent tens of millions of dollars for positions that are actually empty at the state level that we don't have any. The senators, the secret of the Missouri Senate chamber is that those senators that were voting on those budget bills have no idea what the money has been spent for, and we've been betrayed by a governor that I think has really gone back on his commitment to be a fiscal conservative.
So I would imagine that under a Governor Igel, there will be no state aid for a Kansas City Chiefs or a Kansas City Royals stadium.
That is exactly correct.
Or a St. Louis Cardinals stadium.
That is correct.
All right. We got this question from Angel of the Ozarks on X. What is Igel going to do to make sure LGBTQ Missourians feel safe and prosperous?
Well, I think that there's a real trap here to fall into this mindset of we're just going to help one division of people over another, or maybe at the expense of others. And I always hesitate to break the population down into any kind of classification. I mean, if we're being honest, the policies that I'm talking about are going to be good for everyone, regardless of your background, regardless of where you're from. It's going to be good for every person in this state to not have to pay rent on their car on December 1st in personal property tax. It's going to be good for every person in this state to not allow foreign countries to buy the farmland in this state. It's going to be good for every person in this state to try to address the illegal immigration crisis in this state.
Well, okay. I am a heterosexual man, but if I were part of the LGBTQ community and I had a choice of living in Missouri where you can get fired from your job for being gay and not be able to have any legal recourse for it, if I'm trans, I have to worry about the government, even as an adult, interfering in getting hormone therapy or gender transition surgery. And I also just have a state government that is just hostile to my existence. Why would I live here instead of a place like Illinois where it's the complete opposite of that?
Well, one, I would disagree with the assessment that we're hostile to anyone's existence. I have not seen that. I mean, the only thing I feel like we're hostile to in Jefferson City is fiscal restraint. So, if you're referring to the bill that we passed last year prohibiting transgender surgeries on children, as an example, I don't consider that hostile to anybody except for those that want to, in my opinion, mutilate children, set children up for permanent medicalization.
You said on the Senate floor you hope those parents left the state, though. How is that not hostile, though?
I said that if they are disappointed in a state that's going to go out of their way to protect children, then if their interest is in harming children, then I have no problem saying that, yeah, maybe Missouri is not the best place for them, because in this state, we're going to protect kids.
You have also said that you would round up and deport undocumented immigrants in Missouri. How would you do this? How much money would it cost? And what safeguards would be in place that you're not arresting and trying to deport people who are legally in this country?
So right now we have 70, it's estimated we have about 70,000 illegal immigrants in this state right now.
And who made that estimation?
That comes from the Heritage Foundation is the latest estimate. Actually, no, I take that back. I believe it comes from the Census Bureau that made that estimate. But
okay.
But I'll say as a caveat, given that President Joe Biden has had the border open for the past years, that number might be wildly undervalued. So there may be many, many more. Either way, the estimate comes down that it's costing the state billions of dollars because the Supreme Court, to go back to the court's decisions, has said that if they try to enroll in our schools, we have to accept them. We allow them to enroll in our institutions and universities. And so there's a tremendous cost. And by the way, that's a criminal act to be in this country, to violate violate immigration law, and they're coming through the same urban areas in St. Louis City and Kansas City that the fentanyl trade is coming through, the human trafficking trade is coming through. And I feel like, and I share this opinion, I think, with a lot of other Missourians, that we have these regimes in those cities that are very soft on crime. So I also happen to believe, because I've talked to a lot of the sheriffs in this state, that we already know where they are. We already know where the illegal immigrants are in our communities. But right now, there's no authority to act at the state level.
So, okay, I will ask this question again. How would you do this? Mm-hmm. How much would it cost? Mm-hmm. And what safeguards would you put in place that you're not arresting people who are illegally allowed to be in this country?
How would we do it? One, I'd declare an invasion under Article 4 of the Missouri Constitution. That would empower the governor to empower the highway patrol, every sheriff in this state, and the National Guard, if necessary, to activate and detain and deport those that are being suspected of being in this state illegally. Now, being suspected of being in the state illegally, you know, our police officers can't, as you know, can't just go and pick up people at random and without any absence of crime. So, of course, there's going to have to be the natural evidence that indicates that these folks are breaking the law, in this case, a federal law, by being here illegally. So we're going to continue to follow those. How much would it cost? Well, I can tell you, we spend hundreds of millions of dollars on our highway patrol. We spend tens of millions of dollars on our National Guard. I don't have the figures of adding up every sheriff in this county, but I'm willing to make available any necessary funds so that this becomes a reality in the state of Missouri.
What sort of pressure would you place on the business and agriculture community to lessen the incentive for undocumented immigrants to come to Missouri to find work? You mentioned that you think that they're coming to St. Louis and Kansas City, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of them are going to rural Missouri to work on farms. So my question is, like, what sort of policies would you tell businesses and agriculture operations to do to make sure that they're not magnets for people who are not in this country legally?
Well, there's already a lot of gates that local small business owners have to comply with in order to ensure that anybody they bring on board is either a citizen or allowed to be here legally. You know, part of the reason, Jason, that we have this problem where you have small business owners that are desperate to find someone and willing to break the law, perhaps, to bring on an illegal immigrant is because the population of Missouri is not growing. I mean, we do not have an inflow of new population, new individuals that are bringing with them their talents, their innovation. Missouri's stagnating. I mean, look what's happening in St. Louis City right now. We have people leaving the city in droves right now. It is the fastest shrinking city in all of America. And when you have this stagnation of the population,
I'm not sure if it certainly has lost population. I'm not sure if it's the fastest losing population.
I think it is. It lost about 1.5% just last year alone.
We may have to fact check that after the fact.
Okay.
So continue.
All right. Okay. So, but it's losing population, and when you lose population, then if you're an employer, every time you hire someone, because you have a closed system statewide, you've just opened up a hole in some other business that needs a worker. Look at the states that are growing. Look at the Tennessees and the Texas and the Floridas. The big consequence, the positive consequence of their policies that they've implemented in those states that we haven't here, is that they have population coming to their state. American citizens picking up from where they're at and going to those red states where there's opportunity.
Isn't it possible that legal immigrants are coming there too? It seems like legal immigration is key to St. Louis maintaining its population, much less gaining population.
If we're talking about legal immigration, we're talking about two different things.
Yeah.
For legal immigration, I have spoken to business owners that would like to see us apply pressure to the federal government to allow for short-term visas to be approved in a better. Listen, if it's legal, if it's a legal path for folks to be able to work here legally, I'm all for it. But I also want to focus on my economic policy is focusing on attracting citizens in particular from other states to want to come to the state of Missouri.
How would your administration respond if Missourians approve a ballot measure later this year that legalizes abortion, given that, and I'm going to agree with you on this, if that passes, it's going to strike down more than just the ban you passed in 2019. It'll strike down a lot of abortion restrictions. And you can't just pass a law after they're struck down because the Constitution's Trump statute. But I imagine that you're going to want to have some sort of response if that ends up passing, and I'd be interested what it would be.
Well, so one, I would make the case that the initiative petition that's being pushed by the abortionists is way out of step with what the thoughts and opinions on this issue is for the everyday Missourian. I mean, it allows for abortion up to birth, and I think that if that passes, and I'm not convinced that it's going to pass because, quite frankly, I believe could continue to believe that Missouri is a pro-life state, and we'll see what happens here in a few months. But if it does pass, then it's going to be even more important that we have a governor that doesn't just continue to sit by and do nothing. I could absolutely see this being one of the top issues that the Republican supermajorities are going to try to deal with, just like when we started 20 years ago, chipping away at the culture of death that's presented by the pro-abortionists. If we have to start that process again, expect me as the governor of the state to be on the front line pushing back against killing unborn kids in the state of Missouri.
If Missourians do end up passing this measure, which would legalize abortion up to fetal viability, could it also be a sign that Republicans overreached by banning abortions for basically any reasons except medical emergency? Like, you can't get an abortion if you're a victim of rape or incest here. Is it possible that that could just be a reaction from Republicans and Democrats that say, Republican legislature, you went too far on this one?
Well, I'd be surprised if that was the case, because even after we did pass all those things, all those restrictions on abortion, some of the toughest in the entire country, of course, Missouri kept sending supermajorities of Republicans back to Jefferson City. So I would be very surprised that to suddenly find out that the same Missouri electorate that's sending these supermajorities of Republicans to pass all these pro-life restrictions suddenly was trying to tell us that we somehow overreached because they keep sending all the supermajorities back to Jefferson City.
So my last question before I let you go, and I'm sure I'm going to have many more questions as this campaign goes on, but for now, I will leave you with this. Why do you think that you are the strongest Republican to go into the general election season, especially if abortion rights ballot initiative amps up Democratic turnout more than usual?
Because I'm the guy, more than anything else, that is talking about trying to break up a status quo in Jefferson City that has really, quite frankly, and I've been watching this for 8 years now, does not care about the challenges that everyday Missourians are going through. I mean, I'm the only candidate talking about getting rid of personal property tax, which affects every single household in this state. I'm the only candidate about talking about truly protecting our farmland by preventing foreign entities from coming in and harming it. I'm the only guy with actual ideas and policy positions that we can debate. I haven't seen that either from the Democratic candidates for governor, and I certainly haven't seen that from my Republican opponents. So these are ideas. You know, there's a archway in the Capitol, and Jason, I'm sure you've seen this before. Over the first floor, one of the first floor archways has an inscription that reads, "Ideas will rule the world." The Missouri I'm thinking about is going to require these big, bold ideas about reducing the tax burden, getting our finances in order, and really taking on that status quo. And it's not going to come from folks that have really benefited from that status quo for years, maybe in some cases for generations.
Senator Bill Igel represents Missouri's 23rd senatorial district and is one of three major GOP candidates for governor. We're planning on having Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe and Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft on this program, as well as featuring the two major Democrats for governor, House Minority Leader Crystal Quaid and businessman Mike Hamra. Senator, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jason.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Missouri's governor's race with St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Kellogg. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. We talked before the break with State Senator Bill Igel, one of three major GOP candidates for governor. And joining us now to talk about the St. Charles County Republican statewide bid is St. Louis Public Radio State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Sarah, welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks, Jason. Good to be here.
What were your big takeaways from our conversation with Igel?
I think one of the biggest takeaways was kind of the branding from Igel on the fractured nature of the Republican Party. That stood out to me a lot, which I find really interesting due to his involvement with the Freedom Caucus and then prior to that, the Conservative Caucus, which is honestly a point a lot of that fracturing, the consternation of that. And The fact that one of his bids was he was going to call, you know, be the Republican to do Republican things, calling on Republicans to do Republican things. And it makes me wonder what he felt that Parson has done in the last 6 years. Is it consternation over on what he feels are really big budgets, or Parson advocating for child care tax credits? Because, you know, even just last year, you know, Parson has advocated for and signed Republican bills, conservative policies. And, you know, the now law barring transgender minors from accessing gender-affirming health care, Parson said last year if they did not pass that, he was going to call for a special session. So it's not like there hasn't been, you know, he hasn't been sitting on his hands a lot of these years, too. So I'm interesting that he is kind of advocating for more action on that. And it also the idea of having Republicans do and trying to be the one to push for those things, it kind of just disregards the nature of the Senate and how the Senate works. So even if Igel wanted to do some of these policies, you know, the filibuster is really strong in the Missouri Senate.
And that was going to be one of my other questions. Based on your experience covering him in the Missouri Senate, do you think that some of the ideas he talked about on the program, like, for example, getting rid of personal property taxes, would run into roadblocks because of the nature of the Senate, basically?
Yeah, I think there would be roadblocks. I think that it's what governors want to get done isn't necessarily what happens in the legislature. I think that Parson's push for, you know, child care tax credit is an example of that. That's something he wanted. He did not get it. And I think that some of the things that he's pushing for would get some roadblocks. I think that, yeah, we'll talk about the personal property taxes more in depth. I think that would get some pushback. I think his proposed, I would assume that he would have lower proposed budgets. I think that would get pushback, maybe not from the House, which does do smaller budgets, but I think the Senate would push back on the funding that needs to happen in some of those sectors. Weirdly enough, I think foreign ownership of farmland, I think, is one that there is actually maybe a consensus between some Republicans and Democrats on that, but there's really different ideas between the Senate and the House on that. So it's not just saying he wants something and he gets it done. There's other bodies he has to work with here.
I know that Senator Igel has been talking about chipping away or eliminating personal property taxes for his entire tenure in the Missouri Senate, but it hasn't happened. Why do you think there is not the momentum to get rid of that funding source, which we talked about on the show, is pretty vital now for local governments?
You know, I think that there's interest, but I think that the question is what replaces that revenue. I'm sure there are some Republicans that maybe not a total elimination, but a reduction in personal property taxes, though some do want a total elimination. And I want to go, I actually found a Kansas City Star article that basically breaks down states. He mentions that lots of states don't have personal property taxes. And I found through this article, 12 states don't. And then there's another 14 that do not have what we call traditional personal property taxes, but they do levy other taxes on vehicle ownership. Texas charges an annual registration tax on registered vehicles. Also, speaking of like makeup revenue, lots of states have toll roads, which is a made up revenue for that too. So I think the big hesitation on that is the fact that there isn't really a backup of where that money would come from that would fund schools, that would fund fire districts. And when talking to Igel, when you asked him those questions, it seems like his plan was to use the surplus of general revenue in Jefferson City. I don't know how much of that surplus would last beyond maybe 1 year, maybe two. And so there's a question of like, where does that come? So I think that's why there's such a pushback on personal property taxes, is there isn't that plan B in theory. That's a fully realized plan.
So let's talk about the dynamics of this race a little bit more. Igel has made a name for himself in the Missouri Senate, either for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, for clashing with Republican leadership. Now, my big question is, how do you think that posture will translate to a statewide election, especially when I know and you know that not every Missourian pays attention to all the drama in Jefferson City?
Yeah, when we're looking at the primary in August, where it is truly like the question of these candidates that we will be speaking to with Igel, I don't know how much the dynamics will matter as much of what happened in the Senate this past session, especially because it's not front and center now. Session is over. We can't pull, oh, well, this conversation happened today and this is what he said about it. We're now kind of in full campaign mode coming into August. And as far as voters will see it, I think that remains to be seen. But, you know, he isn't very popular among some of his other Republican senators, more, you know, like Senator Sirpoy, for example, or even Governor Parson. And I think that that could mean opposition in other forms of election form. So it might not be voters, but maybe you have, you know, you know, Governor Parsons dumping for somebody else or advocating for a different candidate. So I think that that could be where we see more of a dynamic change, not so much in what voters see every day, but the coalition that he may or may not have built on the way to this particular moment of the campaign.
And I think a bigger question is about the Republican Party electorate, because I don't think there's any question that the Missouri Freedom Caucus has ardent fans within Republican circles. I think the question is, are the types of policies that he and the Freedom Caucus are advocating for, does that find favor with a wider Republican electorate than just those hardcore Republican activists?
Yeah, I think that's what we have to wait for with the primary. I think it remains to be seen. And I think you're right. There is absolutely ardent supporters in their corner. They had a rally this year at the Capitol that I think was much bigger than I think a lot of us thought it was going to be. And it shows that there is support. But, you know, online isn't real life. And I think we've talked about that before, of like support on X, formerly known as Twitter, or, you know, that those corners, those echo chambers, I think do show that, like, oh, I have support for this, and these are the people that support, and they show up. But that's not everyone. So I think that ultimately, when it comes to policy, I think that what Igel is advocating for and Ashcroft is advocating for, they might lead to a split personally, but I think that it just depends on whether or not that's going to translate to votes.
Yeah, and when analyzing this race between Ashcroft, Kehoe, and Igel, like, there has been some conjecture that Igel may be like a spoiler for Ashcroft because they're both considered more quote unquote conservative than Kehoe. I could foresee a scenario, though, where if Ashcroft sort of descends really quickly, that Igel could kind of be Kehoe, who has the most money out of any candidates and has a lot of institutional support. That could be Igel's path to victory, basically. He has to have Ashcroft kind of plummet in esteem. I feel like there's no other way for him to win this race.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting point. And I think that I do agree that that would be his path forward. But you have to wonder, even if there's like misstatements or if Ashcroft were to stumble, there's still name recognition there. So that's a really, I think that's a big advantage for Ashcroft too, is just knowing, you know, there's precedent there of that name in power in Missouri. And so I think that that, I do think that that is kind of the situation of these two maybe counteracting, and that ultimately benefits, in theory, Kehoe, but I'm not sure. I also want to point out to you that I think that also Igel's presence, as well as Ashcroft, has really also pulled this race more to the right than it would have been, and like issues and topics that would be that are talking about wouldn't necessarily brought up if there were other candidates in the race. So I think that also is worth crediting him with this conservative brand is pulling this Republican race to the right.
In the last minute or so we have left, we did get some official news that the aforementioned abortion initiative, which would legalize the procedure up to what's known as fetal viability, if it gets enough signatures, it's going to be in November, not August, contrary to what some people may think. It would be in November. How do you think that's going to affect things going forward, including the fact that this won't be in during the primary season, so it's not going to create a turnout among Democrats?
No, I think that this ultimately will, I mean, you talk about more, I think more people will vote on it. Obviously, people vote in November more than August, so I think we're going to get more input from Missouri voters on it. I think ultimately, you did a really great story. I'm going to do kudos on how this amendment might not move the needle for Republicans or Democrats, just because there are plenty of Republicans that have signed the initiative petition that would legalize abortion. And so there will be plenty of voters, I imagine, that vote yes to legalize abortion, but would still vote for Republicans. So I'm not sure how much it's going to move the needle on election basis, but I can't imagine that it hurts Democrats.
And also, voters in August will be voting on a redo of a minimum funding for Kansas City police and exempting property taxes for child care centers. I feel like those are going to be a little less controversial than what we may see in November.
I think that's a safe bet.
Sarah Kellogg is St. Louis Public Radio State House and politics reporter. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.